Hello and welcome to episode 388 of the UK True Crime Podcast. I'm Adam. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. As you know, the cases I cover come from a variety of sources, with many suggested by you, and I always encourage you to let me know which stories you'd like me to cover. This one today was inspired by ex-politician and now successful podcaster Rory Stewart, his book, which I would recommend, by the way. When he was at the Ministry of Justice, he said that this case shocked him to the core, and it really is the absolute stuff of nightmares. Okay, so let's quickly set some context with our Guest of the Month and Year game. Top of the UK music charts were Clean Bandit with Rockabye. The first artist I can pronounce with any certainty in the US charts was at number 5. It was DJ Snake and friend of the show, The Bieber, with Let Me Love You, Let Me Love You, Let Me Love You. And in Australia, the number 1 spot was James Arthur with Say You Won't Let Go. This month saw the TV series The Grand Tour premiering on Amazon Prime Video. It starred Jeremy Clarkson, Richard Hammond and James May. Donald Trump was elected the 45th president of the US, defeating Hillary Clinton with an electoral college victory of 304 to 227. Staying on politics, sort of, Paul Nuttall was elected as UKIP's new leader. Oh my goodness, remember him? And there was absolute horror in South London, as 7 people died and 61 were injured when a tram derailed close to Sandylands tram stop in Croydon. Okay, so did you get the year? It was November 2016. Now, before we start, I must pass on my thanks to Julie Bindle, whose account of this story I've relied on heavily in this podcast, and you can find the link to this and all my sources for all my shows in my show notes. Today's story comes from Bilston in the West Midlands, a small town around 3 miles southeast of Wolverhampton and 130 miles northwest of London. When we joined today's story in 2016, 80-year-old Margaret Skidmore was the mum to 5 children, Joyce, Jim, Alison and Irene and Lisa, and the family were a very close one. Margaret's husband had died 13 years before, and for 56 years, Margaret had lived in her home in Bilston, close to her children, and like so many other close families out there, they looked out for each other. 37-year-old Lisa was the youngest of her children. Lisa was a hard-working nurse based at nearby New Cross Hospital. She absolutely adored her job, and she often stayed on for an hour or more at the end of her shift. Her patients loved her, as you can imagine. And Lisa, one of her dreams was about opening an old person's facility of her own, where she could look after the residents to a really high standard. Lisa enjoyed living alone, and she spent a lot of time reading crime novels, science fiction, and watching programmes like The X-Files. But her real love was Disney. She got interested in it when she was about 4 years old, I think Mickey Mouse, and then she visited Disneyland for the first time, Disneyland Paris, when she was 18, and she went 4 times after that. She just loved the magic and happiness of it all, and she collected Disney memorabilia, often browsing antique markets and similar places looking for rare pieces for her collection. In fact, just before we pick up the story today in November 2016, Lisa had spent a fun day in Wales with her mum and sister Joyce, where she bought a full-size Mickey Mouse. It was so big, the new purchase had to be strapped in the seatbelt on the journey home. On the 24th of November, Lisa wasn't feeling very well, so she stayed at home away from work. Her mum, Margaret, decided to head to Lisa's home on her way to the shops, just to see how she was, as they live very close to each other. She let herself into Lisa's house, just like she has so many times before, on this ordinary day. But there was nothing, nothing ordinary about this day. Not long before, 55-year-old Leroy Campbell had climbed into Lisa's first floor bedroom using a ladder. Unbeknown to Lisa, 3 days earlier, whilst wandering the local area, looking for someone to attack, he clocked that Lisa lived alone and had identified her as a potential victim. Inside her bedroom, where a sick Lisa was resting, Campbell put the terrified Lisa through an utterly terrifying sexual attack for 2 hours before strangling her to death. Lisa was just 37 when she died. It was soon after this when Lisa's mum Margaret entered the house. Campbell was still at the scene, hiding behind the kitchen door. Margaret explains what happened next. He punched me in the face and strangled me by wrapping a cord around my neck. I thought I was going to die. I blacked out. When Margaret regained consciousness, Campbell was no longer in the house. But he left her lying on the floor of the living room, having set fire to the bedroom where he'd killed Lisa. He then turned the gas cooker on to full, hoping to destroy all the DNA evidence that pointed to him being the double murderer. Fortunately, Margaret was saved by one of Lisa's neighbours. He saw the flame. She saw that the fire had taken hold. They called 999 and came into the house to rescue Margaret. Margaret's daughter Alison picks up the story of what happened next. Joyce phoned me and she said that Mum had been attacked at Lisa's house. I had no idea that Lisa had been murdered. So along with her husband Bob, Alison rushed to Lisa's home in a state of panic and uncertainty. And when she got there, she saw all the emergency services out in force. There were 2 fire engines and 13 firefighters, 2 ambulances, 4 police cars, and a first response car, said Alison. Mum was being attended to by paramedics. She had an oxygen mask on and she said, "Lisa was gone." Her voice was trembling. I saw the ambulance door open and I could see Lisa's leg. There was a police officer by us and Joyce and I asked him about Lisa, but he didn't answer. It was then I knew that she had died. I couldn't take it in. Finding out about Lisa while getting my head around the fact that my mum had nearly died was hell. Now on this podcast, as you know, I try to get into the detail of just what really happened to those people most affected by terrible events and just what they go through. Margaret and her family have freely shared the horror of the following hours and days. When Margaret was taken in an ambulance to the very hospital where Lisa worked, with her was a police officer and her daughter Alison. Margaret was checked over by the medical staff and amazingly, her only physical injuries were severe bruising all around her face and down to her neck. Alison described what happened next. They asked me if I would help Mum get into a gown and bag up all her clothes as the police needed them for forensic evidence. More police arrived and one was stationed outside the room. 2 female officers were asking us questions and the forensic officer was taking photos of Mum. It was just surreal. After all that had happened that day, medical staff understandably wanted Margaret to stay in hospital to be observed and looked after. But Margaret was having none of it. She told them that she was returning home for her children. Now let's hear from her daughter, Alison, again. None of us could comprehend what had happened. We were all empty. The look on Mum's face haunts me to this day. The light had gone out of her eyes and her life. She didn't go to bed for 2 nights and didn't leave the house, apart from we had to go to the police station for 6 weeks. Leroy Campbell was picked up and arrested 3 days later. He was living in a hostel in the same village as Lisa and was being supervised in the community after being in custody for 17 years. He had 6 previous convictions for 11 offences, including rape, burglary, attempting to strangle, acquisitive offences and drug-related offences. In 1983, he entered a nurse's home and attempted to choke or strangle her with intent to rape or otherwise sexually assault her. He received a 7-year prison sentence for that. Then in January 1992, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for rape, which he committed after breaking into the flat of a woman and her 5-year-old child and threatening her with a knife. He was made subject to the requirements of the Sex Offenders Register for life. In May 2000, he was sentenced to life imprisonment with a tariff of 5 years for offences of false imprisonment. He also received concurrent determinate sentences of 8 years and 3 years respectively for linked to offences of burglary times 2 with intent to rape and indecent assault. The tariff on this sentence expired in 2005, but still he was not released from prison for another 8 years as the professionals didn't think he was ready. It was only in June 2016, the year he killed Lisa, that the parole board directed his release. On the 25th of July 2016, Campbell was released from prison on life licence. This included a condition to reside at an approved premises and conditions designed to address aspects of his behaviour and to protect victims. As I said, the hostel he was released to was in the same town as Lisa. That same month, Campbell's probation officer went on leave, and another probation officer who knew the case provided temporary cover. On the 17th of October, 1 week after moving into the supported accommodation, Campbell attended the office for a scheduled interview with the cover probation officer. He was extremely tearful and said he felt anxious, vulnerable, and isolated. He said these feelings were triggered by the absence of his children who were away on holiday. Campbell reported that similar feelings had been triggers to previous offending and that he'd taken to looking at open windows when he was walking around. When he was asked by the cover probation officer whether he was having thoughts of burglary, Campbell confirmed that he was thinking of the same offences as before. When it was put to him that surely he wasn't thinking of rape, he confirmed that he was. Campbell returned to the office 2 days later without an appointment, stating he still felt isolated. He said he thought he might want to return to prison, as he found things were harder in the community. Then on the 24th of October, Campbell returned to the office for a planned appointment. He seemed in a better mood and more settled. He said he'd spoken with two police officers and had a further visit from the police sex offender manager. He said he didn't feel it was necessary to return to the hostel. He was feeling better and his family were due to return home soon. The cover probation officer was convinced that all was now well, and the senior probation officer supervising spoke to Campbell herself, and she was satisfied that his mood had improved considerably and decided not to return him to the hostel. The probation officer responsible for Campbell returned from annual leave on the 7th of November, and the following day Campbell came to the office and discussed the events of the past few weeks. Campbell left the office in a positive mood. The probation officer visited Campbell at home with a support worker on the 18th of November. Again, Campbell was entered as settled. The probation officer planned to visit Campbell at home the following week on the 25th of November, but was delayed at court. The probation officer contacted the accommodation to speak to Campbell, but was informed that he'd gone out. Staff reported that Campbell seemed well and there were no issues. The probation officer arranged a visit in 3 days' time, and on the 28th of November 2016, the day the probation officer was due to visit, he was informed by the police that Campbell had been arrested for murder. At his trial in May 2017, Campbell pleaded guilty to murder, rape, attempted murder, and arson with intent to endanger life. Campbell has refused to give an account of what happened that morning, but Lisa's family at least have the reassurance that nobody else will suffer at his hands, as the judge ordered that he'd never be released from prison. And Campbell completely disregarded the feelings of the family in other ways too. For example, he made an application for a second post-mortem. Now, he made the application just 1 day before the time limit for application expired. It had, as you can imagine, regrettable consequences for the family and their grief. The family suspected he had self-serving reasons for the request rather than any sort of pursuit of justice. The inquest into Lisa's death was, as you can imagine, pretty brutal about the numerous failures from the authorities which contributed to her death. Jurors at Black Country Coroner's Court found that police and probation staff failures made, and I quote, more than a minimal contribution to her unlawful death. They recorded a narrative verdict. It was found that Campbell disclosed to probation he was experiencing low mood, negative thoughts and feelings that had led to his previous offence, but this key information wasn't shared. Jurors also noted that there were failures to document information and conduct even basic checks, and there was no sufficient consideration given to the option of recalling Campbell to prison. At the time, that was almost like the last resort, it seems. After an independent review into the actions of the probation service, a supervisor was sacked for gross misconduct and a probation officer was demoted. The former Justice Minister, Rory Stewart, the minister at the time, he met the Skidmore family twice to personally apologise for how the family had been let down by the system. The Probation Service has acted on recommendations made from this case to improve how it works with the police and has put in place measures to help prevent this happening again. A Ministry of Justice spokesman said, "This was an appalling crime. We have apologised to the family for failings in this tragic case. Our thoughts remain with them." But of course, these words, it's all too late for Lisa's family. He just can't understand how Campbell was still a free man able to kill Lisa. Alison says, "Somebody is responsible for the loss of my sister and the near loss of our mum. When somebody is taken and it's preventable, it adds more to the loss." And Margaret continued, "I've been a mother for 62 years, and this is the worst thing that could possibly happen." Lisa's sister Alison told how the fire destroyed family photographs at Lisa's home, which Lisa had been collecting for a project. "We have no visual memories of her," Alison said. "We're left with nothing, absolutely nothing." And poor Margaret clearly has suffered terribly through the loss of her daughter. She was diagnosed by a psychiatrist as suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as severe depression, anxiety and stress. "Mum is too frightened to open the door since it happened," said Alison. "She can't sleep unless all the windows are closed and locked, even in the height of summer." Let me end with a direct quote from the incredibly moving article from Julie Bindle when she was leaving the house, the family house, the Skidmore's family house. "Just before I leave, Alison shows me the attic. It's full of Lisa's things, mainly Disney memorabilia, but also some of her other personal effects. I hate coming in here," she tells me, barely containing her tears. "I said to the probation service, don't give me a monthly update or anything on Campbell," Alison tells me, picking up one of Lisa's Disney toys. "Just tell me when he's dead." So what do you make of what we've heard today? In my introduction, I told you I heard about this story initially in Rory Stewart's book when he was a justice minister. Here is some of what he said, just one paragraph, about when Margaret came to see him in his office. She sat quite still, well back in her chair. The light was behind her, emphasising her silhouette. Her neatly curled white hair held severely back. The set of her shoulders and her strong hands folded over her chest. As she spoke, she looked directly at me, watching my face. "Your colleagues let him out of prison. Your probation officers failed to recall him to prison. Let me explain what that meant you did. My daughter Lisa was a nurse. This man climbed through our window after Lisa had got back from her day shift," she said slowly and clearly. "Then he grabbed Lisa and he raped her. Then he killed her." Her eyes fixed unflinchingly on mine challenged me to imagine the scene. "I am 83. Before he left, he set fire to the house and wrapped the Hoover hose around my neck and tried to rape and kill me too. Nothing I'd seen in Iraq or Afghanistan had prepared me for what it took to look this woman in the eye, or to take responsibility for what our collective failure to manage and recall a prisoner had meant for her life." It's just the most shocking story, isn't it? It's everyone's fear, being attacked and killed by a total stranger, just being targeted at random. And for Lisa, this all happened in her own house too. The one place where we should always feel safe at all times, whatever else is happening in our lives. Lisa, an absolute joy by all accounts, was attacked and killed in her own bedroom. It's hard to comprehend the terror she must have felt in that long 2-hour ordeal. The attack is obviously ghastly and terrible, but this is exacerbated when this man had a track record of similar attacks, and the family can't help but wonder if those responsible for our safety had done their jobs properly, would Lisa still be alive today? Moreover, they want to know why a dangerous man wasn't recalled to prison when he admitted feeling urges to carry out another attack similar to the ones he was responsible for before. And as we have said on many occasions on this podcast, all the inquests, reviews and other steps taken by the authorities, it's all fine, but it doesn't bring Lisa back. Just 37 and with so much life left to live, All our thoughts go out to the friends and family of Lisa. Reflecting Lisa's love of Disney, her family hoped to raise £10,000 to send disadvantaged children and their families to Disneyland Paris, so that they too could enjoy the magic that Lisa so loved all of her life. At the time of its launch, her sister Alison said, "Lisa can't go anymore, but we hope that other children, who might not otherwise get the chance to have a holiday like this, can enjoy the magic that Lisa so loved." And in July 2019, the first youngsters to benefit from their efforts travelled to Paris on a trip organised by the charity Embrace, which helps child victims of crime to build happy memories on their road to recovery. And the charity presented the Skidmore family with the Fundraiser of the Year award. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the UK True Crime Podcast. To discuss this story and any other aspects of UK True Crime, please head to Facebook and join almost 93,000 of us whom we talk UK True Crime 24/7, even on Christmas Day. And to support the show, please do head to patreon.com/UKTrueCrime for 75 full-length bonus episodes and loads of other exclusive content, including a chance to enter the competition for backstage tickets for my live show in the northeast of England on the 2nd of June. A huge thank you to the latest members of this community, that is, Rose Archer and Michael Cartwright. Thank you both so much. Your support is so much appreciated. And the next bonus episode, purely for supporters at Patreon, is out this week. That's patreon.com/UKTrueCrime. Okay, so that's all for me for another week. I'm off to change my settings on Facebook to avoid those horrible reels advertising the King of Boredom's latest tour. Goodness gracious. So until we speak again on Tuesday, please do take it easy. And remember, despite all the others, stay classy. Cheerio for now.